I'm pleased to introduce Mike Pappas from Orban Labs. Mike's a contributor big time to the Wisconsin Broadcast Association. He presented at the summer conference that we had in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin last year. His bio is on page 24, so I won't go over that with you, but you know that Mike's a forward thinker, and I think we're going to hear about more forward thinking from him right now. Mike?
So I want to start off this morning with just a note. If anybody's interested, there is a clean, used, Nautel NX50 sitting in L.A. for $70,000, and you pick it up. Come and see me after the show, okay? Be it an excellent backup or replace a DX50 or, I don't know, pirate radio on AM. The NX50s are actually agile, according to Jeff Welton, and you can pretty much run it anywhere in the band. So if you have a big truck and a need, that's a pretty good deal on a great transmitter. So welcome you all to my presentation today. As we all know, it's election season, so I thought I'd start off by telling you who I'm going to vote for. So from 1956, who's been around since 56? Okay, this is Mad Magazine's 1956 What Me Worry candidate for president. And I thought with all of the election stuff that this is a perfect way to start off my presentation. I'm not going to go through all this stuff. If you don't know who Orban Labs is and what we do, I have other problems. But it'll be in the PDF. That'll be available after the show, which is great. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about AM. I'm an AM junkie. Started off, my dad built me a crystal radio set. And in the middle of the night, I would sit under the covers and listen to WTMJ. So we've done a fair amount of work in AM. When myself and my business partner and our private investment firm purchased Orban in 2016, I spent a couple of days with Bob, which was kind of like being Beaker from the Muppets, okay? Hair was all standing up, eyes were glowing red, smoke was coming out of my ears, and on my last day with Bob, he said, "Hey, I want to show you something. I've been working on this new AM processor for about 4 or 5 years, and the current owners of Orban don't think there's a market for it." And I said, "Well, we're going to do this." And so 3 years later, I installed the first one at KSEN in Shelby, Montana, which is 20 miles from the Canadian border. And the rest, as they say, as Bob says, we were an overnight sensation that took 4 years. But in New York City alone, we're on all the big stations, and it's been a really fun project because I get to play with customers' transmitters, and my biggest fans for that are Bonneville, who kind of like, "Hey, sure, you got some special software, you want to try stuff, you can go out and blow up our stations." So let's talk about air change. So I kept five public radio stations on the air for 19 years. And I want to just say that out of the gate, that the last thing we ever really paid attention to was how we sounded on the air. And that's primarily because we were doing everything in engineering except paying attention to what was coming out of the far end of the sausage-making machine, right? We were more concerned with fixing the water leak in the men's room, jump-starting the GM's dead battery, and doing everything under the sun except paying attention to what our product was. And, you know, we all know what an air chain is, right? It's a complete system from source to transmitter. This is WHRU. I was out doing an Ennis workshop at their facility, and so I was like, "Hey, what's your air chain look like?" And so they gave me some hand scratch stuff, and I turned it into a slide, which I've shamelessly used ever since. So, you know, we obviously have some input sources, microphones, satellites, automation. This is going into it. They have a Wheatstone console and a blade, and they have a Sage NDX box, which I refer to as Sage, the destroyer of audio. That's funny. Come on. And they felt that they had to have something in front of the STL, so they've got an Angry Audio C4 processor. They're using RTL fiber out to the transmitter site. They were fortunate enough to have a piece of dark fiber there. And at the far end, they turned that back into audio, into a Wheatstone processor, and into an Autel transmitter. Where's Jeff Walton? So we know what the sources all look like. At some point, we've got consoles, routers, EAS, where are the guys from FEMA, PPM encoder, processing, STL. This is WETA in Washington, D.C. They're a classical music station, public. And you can see that their plant is pretty complex, and they've got two 950 STLs along with dark fiber and a backup, which is internet. So they're really working hard on making sure they're on the air all the time. So we bought Orban, and William Harrison from WETA approached me at our first NAB show, and he said, you know, we broadcast classical music, and our big problem is classical music's got this big of a dynamic range. And our problem is our listeners in their listening environment have about this much dynamic range. And he said, we get consistent calls from listeners saying we're off the air when we're not. And the silence alarms go off. So Bob, in his infinite wisdom, came up with a way of lifting the bottom end of the dynamic range up by 20 dB. It's called parallel compression. And we put it together, and I looked at it, and I didn't want to make it into a product because I didn't think there was enough market for it. So we just gave it to him, and we told William to put it on the air and just put a couple of dB in, let everybody get used to it, wait a couple of weeks, and put a couple dB more into it. So over a period of about 8 weeks, they went from like no lift on the bottom end of the dynamic range to about 20. And the golden ears didn't burn them in effigy in the parking lot, and all the silence detectors stopped silencing, and listeners stopped calling. That's been on the air since 2017, and we're about to replace it with a next generation. But the point is trying to understand a little bit about where people are listening, right? And so one of the things that's not in one of my slides here is about 90% of your listeners are in vehicles. So if you're not listening to the output of your stations in vehicles and in a couple of different vehicles, because they all sound different, you're probably not doing your listeners a good service. Transmitter sites, we all know we got a transmitter site, hopefully a transmitter. Anybody need an NX50? There's one in LA for a great deal. You just got to pick it up. Some folks run EAS at transmitter sites. Usually there's a recipient of an STL out there. This is a fun little setup. KLAA in Anaheim is the radio station for the Anaheim Angels Major League Baseball team. So they have their own 50 kW radio station, which is great, and they've got about three different ways to get signal out to the site, and the primary one being satellite, which is C-band, and then they have a terrestrial microwave backup, and then their ultimate world comes to an end backup is internet. So they got a new chief engineer, called me up, ordered one of our XPN AMs, put it on the air, and hated it. And so I said, well, send me an hour of your next game off air, and let me take a listen to it. So a couple of days later, it shows up in my inbox. I send a copy off to Bob. I take a listen to it, and it's horrible. It's wheezing, it's pumping, it's breathing. It was ugly. So I asked the engineering guy there to put his hand physically on everything from the output of the plant to the uplink, every bit of it. Get a piece of paper, draw it all out, find everything. So a couple of days later, he calls me up and he said, I'm just digging around, and in the back of this rack, there was this thing called an Arian. And he said, what is this thing? And I said, well, it's the destroyer of audio. And I said, unplug that thing and bypass it and let's see what happens. So the other problem, of course, was they were running an Arian at the studio side and they'd left the AGC on in the XPN processor. So the two of them were having quite the battle royale going. So he bypassed it and called me a couple of days later and said, well, things are getting better, but it's still not 100%. So I said, great, send me another recording. So he did. So the press box is located about 450 feet away from the studios. And it's got a Mackie mixer, which is perfectly serviceable. And it's feeding balanced line level audio all the way back to the studio. And I said, let's take another one of those projects and start at the Mackie mixer and go all the way through and look at every piece of wire through that 450 foot run all the way back to the input in the plant. So he calls me a couple of days later and he goes, I found a telco closet about halfway back and there was this box in there called a compeller. And I said, perfect. Remember what we did with the Arian? Yes. Do the same thing with the compeller. I get a call from him the next day, he goes, now we have a really weird problem. I said, what's that? And he said, well, when the announcer talks, we hear the first word twice. Okay. How are we doing that? So if you look on the block diagram here, there's something called a Titus Technologies auto switcher. And what was happening is when the quiet portion of the game, when the crowd noise dropped down, the switcher was switching from the C-band primary to the satellite backup. Okay, and that switch, because it was just kind of noise, was really inaudible. However, when the announcer started talking, the terrestrial microwave was about a second and a half faster than the C-band. The Titus would wake up and then switch back over to the C-band, so you'd hear the first word twice. Okay, so how do we fix this problem? We got a hold of the guy that mixes the baseball game, and we had him run up the crowd noise by about 5-6 dB, because I didn't want to put some sort of compressor in the midst of all this stuff. Problem fixed. The point is that unless we're listening for these problems, unless we're paying attention to these problems, right? Unless we've stopped unplugging the John in the men's room and jump-starting the GM's dead battery, we're not paying attention to this stuff. And one of my other favorite AM stories is I get a call from one of our biggest customers, and they're like, our Detroit station sounds terrible. Can you go out and fix it? Sure. Get on a plane, get to the Hertz counter, rent a car, dial up the station on the AM in the car, which, by the way, had AM in it, and AM, it's good in vehicles. And it was terrible. And so they had an XPN AM out at the transmitter site, and the transmitter site was getting fed a digital STL, and this thing should all sounded great, and it was horrible. So the customer was really tuned up to make better audio. So we start doing the same thing. Let's look at what's coming out of the plant, which is all digital. Let's figure out what's going on there. So of course we find a compeller running into an Arian, running about 35 dB of compression into the digital STL, and the XPN AM had its AGC turned on, and that was ugly. So we got rid of all that stuff, and I took the Arian and the compeller out into the parking lot, and I ran them over with the rental car a couple of times. And I did that to make sure that if I put it on the shelf, somebody didn't grab it and use it for something silly, right? Because that's how we end up in these positions. So we cleaned all that stuff up, and the customer was absolutely insistent, even though they had a digital STL out to the transmitter site, they were insistent on having an AGC in front of the STL. So we put a 6300 in, we turned the AGC off in the XPN AM, and then we took a listen to it. And I'm looking at the input to the 6300 at the studio side, and the levels are all over the place, right? So after some delicate negotiations, I was allowed to sit in and watch the morning show. Now, this group had a dedicated board op. That's all their job was. And I'm watching this thing, and I come to the horrific realization that the only thing the board op is doing is turning channels on and off. And those slidey things, and those things that go like this with the green and the yellow and red, that was not part of their equation. Their job was to simply turn on and off channels. And of course, that meant that levels going into the 6300 were about 35 dB from top to bottom. Now the 6300's only got 24 dB of correction on its AGC, right? Which means that 6 dB or 8 dB of that was going somewhere else, and that wasn't pretty. So there was another round of big meetings and delicate negotiations, and everybody decided that the engineering department should do a little training with the board ops. And this is important. You know, in my career, I went through a whole bunch of PDs and GMs, okay? And the only thing that was consistent was engineering always tried to make sure whoever was going on the air had some sort of a rudimentary understanding of what the slidey things were, okay? And what the little green metering things were. And beyond that, which end of the microphone you talk into. Listen, trust me. There's a very intricate four-site single-frequency network that's at KCSN. So KCSN and KSBR are on the same frequency in the LA basin, separated by 80 miles. And depending upon the weather, you could sit in KCSN's parking lot and hear KSBR better than you could hear them, and the true reciprocal of that work. So after a number of years of delicate negotiations, they turned this thing into a monster single frequency network. Oh, and all the destructive interference between the two stations lined up right through the middle of, wait for it, Los Angeles. So, right? So it's nothing like 8 million people that can't hear your station. And they're using AT&T dedicated switched Ethernet to get all of that sent out because an 80-mile microwave length through the middle of the LA basin was going to be very expensive and probably not so reliable. That's been on the air since 2017, and they've had one single outage. And it costs them about $1,400 a month for all circuits. Okay. Air chain evaluation. When was the last time we took a solid look at everything that's in your air chain? And the problem is that if you've inherited a site, right, or you're a recent addition, you may not know where the bones are buried and where things are hiding in closets and under giant piles of wire in the back of racks, or things have been added or changes have been made and then somebody moved on or the format changed or something else. It's real handy to build a block diagram of your air chain. That also gives you a shot at when things go horribly wrong of trying to figure out where they've gone horribly wrong from. And the other part of this is to listen to things. And a great set of closed back headphones and some sort of headphone amp that you can plug in and listen and critically evaluate things are really a good plan. Listen to everything. Here's an interesting thing. How many D to A and A to D conversions can you possibly have in an air chain that doesn't need them? Okay, so they've got a Wheatstone console. It's going in digitally into a Wheatstone blade where they turn it into analog, where they run it through an EAS box, where it comes out analog, where it goes into an Angry Audio C4 compressor, which turns it into digital to do the compression thing, then turns it back into analog and shoves it into the RTL. If that doesn't make you dizzy, I don't know what will. Mr. Toad's Wild Ride is closed at Disneyland. That used to be an e-ticket, but you have to be old enough to remember it. And then they take it out to the transmitter site digitally, so we've converted it from analog to digital again, shipped it on fiber, switched it back to analog, stuck it into a Wheatstone, and then run standard analog composite into the Nautel. So there's like about 8 analog to digital conversions and back again in this thing, about 90% of which you don't need. So the quick and easy fix, swap the analog to digital, it's a cable move, it's zero cost, right? Take the Wheatstone out, AES, stick it into the Sage EAS box, EAS boxes, AES. Wow, I don't think I have enough coffee yet this morning for that. Run digital into the Angry Audio C4 compressor, take the analog out of that into the Artel. The Artel did not have a digital input, so we were kind of stuck using analog. And then the Wheatstone FM55, I think, has DMPX output, which you could run easily into the Nautel. So I'm going to tell you one of the interesting secrets. We build the world's greatest composite output. It's amazing. Bob holds our feet to the fire. It's got to do 70 dB of stereo separation. It's got to be flat from DC to daylight with a small bump at channel 6. Okay, that was the pitch to television people. You take that analog composite output that we've spent a whole ton of money on, and you stick it into somebody's transmitter that takes it and converts that analog signal into, wait for it, digital, right? And I can pretty much guarantee you that their 880 converter process isn't anywhere near as good as our digital analog. If you have the ability to run DMPX into your transmitter, your listeners will enjoy it better, okay? Because it gets us around a whole ton of D to A to A to Ds. Okay. You know, what are the advantages of running an all-digital air chain? Better signal-to-noise ratio, lower distortion. How many of you are in PPM markets? Right. What do we all live or die on? PPM. The guys that I fixed that had the Arion and the compeller all stacked, they get weekly Nielsen numbers, and their Nielsen numbers went up by 25% by just cleaning up the air chain problems. And that got everybody's attention at the sea level. Okay, PPM we'll talk about in a second, but maximizing PPM encodability is a direct tie-in to clean audio at high enough density. If you have an STL that is old enough to go into a bar and order a vodka tonic, you might want to take a look at it, okay? And I can tell you from experience, I put an 11 gig, 13 mile microwave shot in, digital, from downtown Denver out to Lookout. We installed that bad boy, it was 100 megabits both ways, life was good. And then I went and completely ignored it for about 4 years. And one day we had a giant windstorm in Denver, and I wasn't thinking much about it. And a couple of days later, we were off the air. Why? Because I wasn't paying attention to the STL. Correct. The microwave dish at the transmitter site had gotten knocked out of alignment in the high winds. I wasn't paying attention to it. I hadn't even set it up to, like, phone me and send me an email when it had dropped below its link budget or the bid error rate had increased. Had no idea, but we were off the air. The point here is, when you put a microwave in, have you noted the receive level, right? Do you know what the margin is? If it's a digital STL, it's going to tell you what your link margin is. You know, a brother labeler and a couple of labels on the ends of those things go a long way to help you figure out whether or not you've got some sort of problem. And that gets me to end connectors. And if I ever see another tower guy use a pliers on an end connector, I'm going to use it on their nose, okay? If you go to the Amphenol RF connector website and you look at the torque value for tightening up an end connector properly, it does not revolve around using a pliers. And the problem you run into is that the female cup becomes distorted when you drive the pin in it too hard, and that leads to all kinds of unhappiness because, at least in Colorado, in the summertime, it could be 100, in the winter times, it could be minus 20. So that thing is moving in and out of there and causing all kinds of grief if that's been distorted. Usually we just hand tighten those on, hit them with a layer of the Scotch self-gooping stuff, and then put a layer of 33 over the top of it. At one time installed a temporary STL link where we didn't even tape it up because it was only temporary. And 5 years later, we got around to untemporarying it. Let's see a show of hands. How many people that happens to? Yeah, right. And it was perfectly fine, all right? But we didn't use the pliers on it. There's a lot of options for STLs these days. If you're running a 30-year-old STL, you really should be thinking about changing it out. There's a lot of great options there. Dark fiber, public internet, dedicated switched Ethernet, IP-based microwaves, licensed microwaves, okay? It's a good plan. Backed up with 5G or Starlink. We've got a couple of customers running PEP waves. We used to put in cradle points. Cradle point got bought by Nokia. They became stupidly expensive. You had to buy their cloud service, which, you know, at least when Jesse James robbed you, he used a gun. Okay, there's some seriously good options there. A customer of ours came to us and said, we don't want to use Starlink, it'll never take ice falling off the tower. So I called around and found the people that make the fairings for SpaceX spaceships. It's a company called Rockwest Composites out of Utah, and I called them up, and they were nice people, and I said, can you build me a radome for a Starlink, and I want to be able to drop a 2-inch ball of ice from 1,000 feet up and have it survive. And they're like, yeah, sure, we can do it. So if you're looking at Starlink and you're going, it'll never survive an ice storm, come and see me. The guys and gals at Rockwest Composite absolutely positively say they'll make one that'll survive it. AGC before the STL. So in the old days when we were running analog STLs, you kind of wanted to put something in front of the STL so that when the people who had no idea what the slidey things and the meter things decided that if you turned everything all the way up, it was just going to get really good. So AGCs were pretty much, you know, the standard. If you're going to use an outboard AGC in front of your STL, it is vitally important that you turn off the AGC in the processor. And I literally have found 75% of the people running an AGC in front of their STL had not turned off the AGC in the processor. And you know, it was amazing. Once we got it turned off, things got a lot better quickly. And that was good. There will be a war between them. Pumping and breathing equals bad audio. The other thing I find out in the field that absolutely kills us is insufficient setup on the AGC. So on the Orban stuff, you want to be running with nominal program level. You want to be running between 9 and 12 dB of AGC action. Normally, I find most customers are running about 3 dB of AGC action, and the problem is when you drop out of the AGC, the downband multiband processing is starved for level, and all of that tends to misbehave and sound really bad. So if you haven't looked at your AGC level since, I don't know, the Carter administration, you might want to see. I'm going to throw some of the, you know, political stuff in there today. It's just fun. You might want to just take a look at that and make sure that, you know, if it's, I'm pretty sure everybody's processor wants to be running about mid-band on the AGC with nominal program. And that's assuming we have some sort of an understanding of what nominal program level is coming out of the studio. And that's a whole different kettle of fish. You might find that you can get rid of the AGC in front of the STL if you've got all your levels and things happy. Less is always more with air chains. I was out putting a XPN AM at WCTS in St. Paul, and I'm listening to it, and it was okay. It was one of the early ones that we put in. I was like serial number 10 or something. And of course, we did this in the middle of COVID. And of course, that meant finding a hotel room and restaurants and everything else was nuts. So we get this thing up and running, and I'm listening to it, and it's okay during the day when they do spoken word. And at night, they were running symphonic music, and it sounded like Satan's shop back. Okay? And I'm sitting in my hotel room, and I've got a Sea Crane Skywave radio, which, by the way, if you haven't seen one of those, they're small, and they have a selectable IF bandwidth to 6 kilohertz, which is great. And I'm listening to it, and it's just awful. And so the next day, I'm out at the transmitter site with our engineering guy, and we're pulling our hair out trying to figure out what's going on and what's gone wrong. And I'm thinking it's everything except the STL. And we spend a day with Bob on the phone, and nobody can figure this out. And I go back out there at night, and it's built on, the site's on a kind of a wet, marshy thing, right? And so we all know what the state bird of Minnesota is. It's the mosquito. And so you had to run really fast between the car and the transmitter building so that you'd have enough blood left in you to actually get some work done. Well, and the thing was, if you used Deep Woods off, that was like their dinner bell, okay? They would smell that and just, you were doomed. And so I was out there, and it's all sounding really bad. So I plug my headphones into my headphone amp, and I disconnect the processor from the STL, and I'm listening to the output of the STL, and it's all clipped. Well, how can that be? They've got a giant analog plant that's all brilliant, right? They've got a STL that takes the analog in, converts it to digital, and ships it out to the transmitter site. The specs say it's good for +4. Well, right? We all know an analog plant, usually +4 nominal, 20 dB of headroom, right? The STL had a heavy clipper in it at +9. So how did we fix that problem? We opened the box up and shoved a 20 dB H pad into it, right? And then we made the 20 dB back up at the far end of that. And all of a sudden, it didn't sound like Satan's shop back anymore. But had I not taken a listen to it, I'd still be running around up there, you know, a couple of years later, trying to figure out why the symphonic material sounded bad at night. The point here is listen, right? Listen to the output of your STL. Listen to the output of the console. Listen to your morning drive time team raw coming out of the console and figure out if the microphones you're using are what you really ought to be using. PPM encoding. PPM encoding, we've done a lot of work with one of our biggest customers on PPM encoding. They've got a whole lab that evaluates stuff for PPM encoding. PPM encoding requires the cleanest, highest density audio you can feed the encoder with. Bad audio, poorly processed audio will negatively impact PPM encodability. At a minimum, PPM encoding should be done after the AGC. In XPN AMs, the PPM encoder is done after all the processing and before the safety limiter, which means it's getting the biggest audio you can absolutely feed it. We fixed a customer in New York City with an air chain problem and some processing issues, and they went from a 6 to an 8. Okay? And that was millions of dollars of revenue. In LA, a 0.1 increase in your PPM numbers is $1 million a year in ad revenue. Paying attention to PPM encoding, you just got to do it. And if you have questions about how to maximize your PPM encodability, come and see me, because we've done unbelievable amounts of work on getting it sorted out and making it work right. One of the things that we got called out to a customer that was complaining that Their PPM encodability was dropping during their morning drive show when their remote host was on the air. The remote host was in Florida, and they were on the air in Denver. And come to find out, the remote host was using, wait for it, mono, 64 kilobit a second MP3. And that was not happy, because the PPM encoder didn't like it. And we just changed it over to AAC at 128, and the encodability skyrocketed, and their PPM problem went away. But you need to look at all those things that are coming into your plant, and what's encodable and what's not happy being encodable. As I mentioned, it's significantly more effective to encode the PPM after all the multiband processing and before the safety limiter. Our customers have done a significant amount of testing between onboard PPM encoding and external PPM encoding with encoding enhancers, and found that internal encoding is better, which is why they're basically migrating to it. Some block diagram for a multiband compressor or multiband processor. If you don't know what one looks like, come and see me after the show. We've done a bunch of testing with our customers have using lossy codecs on PPM encoded audio, and that's a very bad thing. Typically, you run about a 20% degradation in PPM decodability if you lossy compress it afterwards. So don't do that. Let's talk about microphones for a minute. Yes, DDT, don't do that. Microphones. We all have microphones, right? Have we all listened to them? Why are we using the microphones we're using? Because we've always used them that way? Let's not do that, right? Microphones come in two flavors, dynamics and condensers. Somebody asked me, what's the difference between a dynamic microphone and a condenser microphone? Instead of dynamic microphones, like taking a standard camera, film camera, and taking a picture. And a condenser is kind of like running it through an MRI machine. There's no place to run or hide. One of the big problems you run into, well, the advantage of running dynamic microphones are they tend to not pick up room problems, which is great, especially if your rooms don't sound particularly good. The biggest issue with them is that the output level is very low. And now, why is that important? Because you need a mic preamp that can run 60 to 65 to maybe 70 dB of gain. And a lot of microphone preamplifiers sound really good at 40 and not so good at 60, and certainly not so good at 70. Now, you won't know this unless you're listening to the output of the console on your morning drive time and you're listening to the way the microphones sound. Typically, microphone preamps that are in trouble tend to elongate sibilances. They also tend to become very noisy. So how big of a problem is this? Well, Shure released an SM7DB, which is a phantom-powered Shure SM7 with up to 28 dB of switchable gain. EV released the RE27ND, which is about 6 dB more output than an RE20. Of course, the problem with the RE27ND is it doesn't sound remotely close to an RE20, okay? If you're gonna do a microphone evaluation, I did this a number of years back. We lined up all the candidates for microphones. We plugged them all into the same Grace preamp. We used the same A to D converter. I brought in most of the main air staff and I had them read the same two paragraphs into every single microphone. We recorded them all into our logic system and played them all back, and then we selected the ones that everybody thought sounded best. Nobody does that anymore. It's something you should do because I'm pretty sure that you use microphones every day on every one of your stations. You can use condensers. We had a couple of them. The room had to be really good to make it work. The talent had to understand that you really needed to work the microphone carefully. It was really easy to chuff them and pop them. But they sounded amazing when they worked. I could swear that I could hear the morning drive time guy's uvula, which is that little weird thing that hangs in the back of your throat. I could hear it wiggle around when he talked. The other big advantage of condenser microphones is their output level is 20 dB hotter than a dynamic, which can get you around some of your microphone preamplifier problems. Listen to the microphones and preamps carefully. We all use microphones every day. Let's see a show of hands. Who's critically evaluated the microphones they're using on the air? Yeah, about so few of you that I'm buying a lottery ticket, okay? But it's important. Why? Because we're on the air with it every single day. And there are some talent that are gonna work better with some kind of microphones than others. You know, if you've got if your on-air talent's really sibilant, then you probably want to use something like an SM7, which doesn't quite have as much high-frequency output. If they're very sibilant, you certainly wouldn't want to put them on a U87, which has got a 8 dB bump at 10K. That'll probably peel the paint off a battleship at 100 yards, but you won't know unless you really take a listen to it. We've already covered this in the last 3 seconds, but training board ops is really important. I'm going to skip to the end of this because I'm out of time. Thank you very much for your time today. We're open for questions. Or did I put everybody to sleep? Daniel.
Yes. Can you hear me now? Okay. Mike, will you elaborate slightly on the gained advantages on the XPN when it comes to dynamic range and transmission distance? I know you were talking about air chains there, but I thought that was worth noting. I've heard you offer some commentary on that.
Well, certainly. One of the things that we've sold over 200 XPN AMs in the United States, which is a whole lot for an $11,000 AM processor. And we get a lot of feedback from customers on two points. One, it fills in holes. Two, it gives you so much higher density that you get over a lot of the RFI noise problems that you have in your markets. And, let's see a show of hands. How many of you have driven up to stoplights in metro areas and heard the buzz off from the LED stoplights? Well, typically our customers are telling us that they're getting between a 10 and a 20 dB advantage because we can hold the modulation density up. The other thing is we have customers running MDCL. So on AM, that carrier that you're generating uses 66% of your power, and it generates nothing usable for the listener. And we have a whole pile of customers running MDCL where they're suppressing that carrier by up to 6 dB. Bonneville's a big proponent of that. And the only way, there's no free lunch. Well, wait, there's a free lunch today. Come on. If you're gonna suppress that carrier by 6 dB, you've got to make it up in modulation density or you're going to hear it. And both Town Square and Bonneville are running everything that will run 6 dB of carrier suppression at 6 dB of carrier suppression. If you run into Martin Stabbert, who's the DOE at Town Square, and ask him how many complaints they received on fringe coverage by running 6 dB of carrier suppression, it's zero. And so is Bonneville. And if you have a Nautel NX series transmitter and you want to run MDCL, would you come and see me? Because I have the hacks for the exciter to change the release time constant because it's too fast. And the quick story there, how much time I got? Like 2 minutes. So I'm out of Bonneville, little station, KSL, Salt Lake City. Nobody listens to it. News talk. We're running MDCL, and I'm listening to the carrier pump between the words, and it makes me crazy. So I complain, and I complain, and I complain to Nautel, and I get nowhere. Jason Aurelius from Bonneville calls up Nautel and says, you either fix this, or we're not buying another transmitter from you. And 2 days later, I get a six-sheet confidential memo on how to go in and command line hack the exciter. So, of course, I get in the car, drive out. I live in Denver, drive out to Salt Lake City, and get out there and find out the transmitter needs a firmware update. And the backup transmitter had a blown-up exciter. And the Bonneville guys are wonderful. They're like, just do it. It's like 13 minutes of off-air time. And they're like, do it anyways. And I was like, not until somebody sends me an email saying it's okay to do this. Okay, with the understanding there is a remote possibility the transmitter will not come back up and you will be off the air. Get the email, push the start button. If you'd have put a Kingsford charcoal briquette in my pants pocket, in 13 minutes, the Hope Diamond would have popped out of it. So it all came back up. They were running 200 milliseconds of release time. Everybody knows what an analog compressor is, right? So release time was 200 milliseconds. So I go to 400 milliseconds and it's better. And I go to 600 milliseconds and I'm really happy with it. And we leave it at that. Where I get a call from them a couple of weeks later. Yeah, it shaved another $1,000 off our power bill. So any other questions? Go ahead.
You mentioned Sage as one of the destroyers of audio. For those of us who have Sage in our plants, are there any tips or tricks on how to mitigate the damage?
I would not run analog through that box. So I'd use the AES in and out.
So it handles digital better than it handles audio, analog.
The other thing is that I have customers that have put their Sage boxes in the processing loop on our processors. And that way, if it goes Tango uniform, it doesn't put you off the air because the box will say, I've lost my loop, and it'll switch back. And you can tell the box to send you a notification that you've lost your EAS loop. So, any other questions? Thank you all for being a great audience this morning. Really appreciate it.
If anybody wants an NX50 for $70,000 in LA, bring your own truck.